You are listening to Mike Seminary and Friends,
a Q1 Network production.
If you have dreams or you're wondering how to make a bigger impact in this world, you're home. Welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends. I'm Deb, Mike's wife. I suggested this idea as a way to keep him busy and out of my way after he retired. So far, it's working. Thanks for listening. It's time for Mike Seminary and Friends.
Welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends, the place where we strive to make a difference, a positive difference, provide you something of value. Heck, from my perspective, we just want to share good stuff. I'm your host, Mike Seminary, and I'm so grateful you've joined us. A big thanks to my friend David Hansen for my theme music, Continental Drift. Search for his work, Serotonin Waters and Moon Dot Soup, on iTunes and Spotify. By the way, I appreciate your comments and guest suggestions. Keep them coming at MikeSeminary.com or Mike Seminary and Friends on Facebook. And please visit us at Apple Podcasts and leave a review. Today, I'm just delighted to have the former Vice President of Student Affairs for North Dakota State University, Go Bison. And while in that role, he also provided leadership at state, regional, and national levels, held offices at national levels, was recognized with awards at national levels. He's a community leader, a volunteer, and a person that, in my opinion, is the epitome of a servant leader. And boy, we sure need more of those nowadays. And now an author and my friend, Prakash Matthew. Prakash, welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends. Thank you for taking time to join me. It's great to see you. And how are you?
I'm doing great. Great to be with you, Mike. And I love the part about the friends part. I think that's even bring me closer to you and having this wonderful conversation we are going to have.
Well, thank you. And, you know, we're going to cover probably a lot of ground today. But I want to share with listeners and followers how I actually came to know you. I knew of your reputation because when someone is involved with an institution the size and the nature of North Dakota State University, and at the level where it's about the students and the culture and the impact and how all of that works to make a healthy community, I knew of you. But it was actually through your relationship with my brother Paul when he was on staff at NDSU. And he would tell me just what a wonderful person you were and how you always went out of your way to treat everyone so nicely. And he just said, he's the neatest guy in the world. And I found out my brother was right. You're the neatest guy in the world.
That's very kind. That's very kind.
So Prakash, before we get to your book, which I read and I loved it, and as we were sharing before we went live, I think it should be some form of addition to curriculum because it's so important to your subject matter. You're not a native to North Dakota. In fact, you came here from a part of the world I've never been to that probably never experiences snow. Yeah. And you ended up in Fargo, North Dakota because God kind of orchestrated that part of your life in a way. Was that an accurate statement?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that last part you said about God orchestrated, and I didn't even realize that was God's plan until much later. I thought, oh, wow, this is kind of great. I get to go to the United States to study. Yes, that's absolutely, it was God's plan.
Well, your native country is India. How if you'd share with the listeners, because I don't want to go a lot into the book because we're going to talk about it, but my goal is to help you sell a bunch of those books, by the way. How was it in the late 60s that you learned of Fargo, NDSU, and would eventually end up in North Dakota?
Okay. That was in 1968. I was studying at a Christian college an institute, agriculture institute, has a very, very good name, this particular institute. So it was very hard to get into this institute. And they will take quotas. So many students from every state can go there. And so I was one of the lucky ones to attend this place. And I was several thousand miles away from my home state where I grew up. And I grew up in the southern part of India, a state known as Kerala. And then I went to a state very close to Delhi and the northern part of India, and a town, or there's no small towns in India, you know that, I think, or a city called Allahabad. And it is called Agriculture Institute and founded by a missionary called Sam Higginbottom. And so it was run by some churches, and Methodist Church and some other churches combined together. They ran the institute, this college. It was most of my professors were from abroad. In fact, my advisor was from British Columbia, and Dr. Warner was my advisor. So this is, I wouldn't call that particular college I went to was a typical Indian college, and they taught everything in English, and people were from all over the world attended this college. Very small, but at the same time, kind of like a private college, any place you go to. In 1968, there was a team of people came to this college, and the principal or the president of the college selected a few students to meet with this team. And one of those people happened to be Reverend Ross Robson. Ross Robson from the First Presbyterian Church in Fargo. And he was part of that team. And so it so happened that by coincidence, I was assigned to be with him, pretty much spend the whole day with him, other than the group meetings we have had that day. I spent most of my time with Ross that day. We talked about just about everything that you want to imagine, about the culture, about the education system, about the political system, any topic you want to think of. I remember one question during that time that he asked me, what are my aspirations about going for higher education and beyond my undergraduate degree? And I was pursuing a degree at that time in agriculture. And I said, well, I have some plans, and probably I'll go and get a master's degree, or we'll see there is a possibility to get an employment after that. That was the end of the conversation. Then before he left, he says, if you get an opportunity to do your higher education in the United States, would you be interested? And I said, of course, you'll be interested. But I think that is not a goal I have, because I never even thought about that. That is the end of the conversation I had. And so 68 until 1970, the next 2 years, Ross worked with my advisor. They were in cahoot. And he made a decision, and he came back here, and he told that to the Presbyterian Church here in Fargo, I found this person, and whether you want it or not, I'm going to bring him here. And this is what did. So they were praying, and for almost 3 years, actually, and they were praying for me, and in every church service, and every once in a while, they talk about my name, and they did that, and he was corresponding with Dr. Warner and all this time. In 1970, I'm not going to go too far into it. 1970 was the first time, I think a year prior to my coming here, and they informed me that they've been making plans. They've been making plans to bring me here, but that's only if I'm interested. And he's going to send me some applications for different universities from the U.S. And he sent me three applications, and Syracuse University, Oklahoma State University, and North Dakota State University. I still didn't remember that. I applied to all three places, and I got admitted to all the places. And I wrote back to Ross and said, I got admitted now to all the places. So which one should I take? He said, I just want to see how good you are, and that naturally you're coming to North Dakota State because I'm here. I'm the one who is bringing you here, and you're coming to North Dakota State University. So that's how I, there's some amazing stories in the book talk about as to what happened. It's a lot of coincidence. It's just a story people will not even believe what happened.
Well, I'm glad you left it there, because for the followers of Mike Seminary and friends and listeners, now you have to buy the book to find out what Prakash was just referring to. And I'm going to address it this way. It was kind of a higher power kind of thing. And when I got to that part of the book, it became such a page-turner for me. This is somewhat off-topic, Prakash. I have a friend by the name of Deshaun Drew. Deshaun used to be part of the Bush Foundation, and he's now the president of Minnesota Public Radio. Okay. And I read a story that I think he and his wife actually wrote. She's a reporter. Angela Davis is her name.
Oh.
He talked about when they came to Minneapolis, they noticed how white Minneapolis was, because yep. they're African-American, they're people of color. And it's about the same time you came to North Dakota.
Yep.
And one of my dearest friends, I love him. I miss him dearly. I learned so much from him, Brother Michael Collins, yep. who was the principal at Shanley.
Yep.
About the same time, you were both involved in Fargo, North Dakota, which was, based on where you came, both of you came from, fairly white. And over time, both of you have had such profound impact, influence on culture and just human kindness. And that's kind of what I want to start talking about. Going back to what my brother said about you, and Michael mm-hmm. Collins was the same way.
Thank you.
He was just like the nicest guy in the world. My sense is you're profoundly other-centered. So many people are self-centered. You're profoundly others-centered, and you always are striving to raise people up and help them. Where in your life did that come from? And if I'm wrong about what I just said, please correct me. I'm wrong a lot. My wife corrects me all the time. But where did that come from for you, Prakash?
Without any hesitation, I can say that came from my father. And well, I had great parents. My mother was the same thing too. But my father was an inspirational leader. He was a pastor. But beyond being a pastor, I think he was an inspirational leader. Before he went to ministry, he had opportunity to work with the Mahatma Gandhi side by side, one of the very, very few Christians in that independence movement working side by side with him. And everything about servant leadership, I heard my father talk about, even when I was a young lad, he will use the word servant leadership. And I knew the whole philosophy behind that. He instilled that in me. And about serving others comes number one. That is one of the core values behind servant leadership. Serving others comes number one. It is nothing about the word boss. In fact, I hated, when I worked at NDSU, I hated the word boss. If somebody would call me, I was almost offended that they call me boss, because that means I'm not serving them well. Because I want them to feel comfortable in terms of, doesn't matter what job they did, what position they were. And your brother Paul talks about, I think one of the things I tried to connect with the people in such a way that they are empowered, they are another human being. And it is not because of my position. I want them to call me Prakash. And I visited, there was one time I had 400 some staff members there, and I could not see them. I had a practice of going and visiting the staff members every week. I could not do that every week, every staff member every week. So I took three departments a week, and I will go and see them. The greatest impact was, and I walk into the dining services dish room, the people who are behind the scenes cleaning those dirty dishes. And nobody really paid attention to them, and it was a job for them. And the steamy room, hot, and they're cleaning dishes. And I walk in there in my visit, and I call them by name, and there were some people, they're wearing glasses, it is all fogged up because of the steam coming out of the dishwasher. I tell you, their smile captured my heart, and I will say, tears with it. And they'll say, Prakash, you here to see me? And it's absolutely, you are an important part of our team. You're an important part of our team. If you don't put the clean dishes out there, you can have the fanciest food out there. But at the same time, if those dishes are not clean, and you are doing the most important part of that, and you're a valuable member for me and for our team, and it doesn't matter whether you're a dean or a vice president, it doesn't matter, and they all play. So I think you answering your question is that all came from my father. And so my father's influence also, most people will talk about Gandhi as the best servant leader. They both, the servant leadership model came from Jesus. The originator of that leadership model came from Jesus. And I think my father knew that. He instilled that in Gandhi. Gandhi bought into it. And so it is a magic. I think then he transferred that to us, children. My father was a person who practiced what he preached.
Mm. I'd like to meet your father. Mm-hmm. But before we start talking, and we'll only scratch the surface on the book, because the goal is to sell a lot of these books. The name of the book, by the way, We Are Called to Do the Right Thing, Prakash, P-R-A-K-A-S-H, Matthew, M-A-T-H-E-W. We'll talk a little bit about the chapters, but I want to go back to when you first arrived.
Can I interrupt you one thing?
Oh, please.
The word selling, you think, I don't want to sell books. I want to get the message out there to people. That's I think that is one. If I connect with people, the message that I'm thankful. First and secondly, I did not write the book to make money. So I should also let the people know that the major proceeds from this will go to the Dakota Medical Foundation. They oversee about 500 charitable organizations. So I want them to utilize the money for the whatever is beneficial for that organization. So I just want to be upfront about that too.
Thank you for that clarification. And I recall you sharing that with me when we made arrangements for this. And when I say my goal is to sell the books, it's because what people can learn in the book will make all of us better people, better communities, healthier, more loving, and it was inspiring for me. And before we move into what the Vice President of Student Affairs and what Student Affairs does as part of the institution of a higher ed institution, I want to go back to when you first arrived in North Dakota. So the differences are, you know, nowadays Fargo is a community, the metro area is about 260,000. Mm-hmm. Where you grew up, that metro area is about 2.2 million. Going back to the early 70s, the comparisons are still the same. The numbers are just different. Back then, it was about 500,000, your metro area. Fargo is about 54,000. So you come to North Dakota, and it's pretty small compared to what you were used to. You stand out in some ways because it's North Dakota. Yep. And then shortly after you get here, you experience winter, which you probably never experienced in India.
Well, except in northern part where I went to college.
Oh.
They have winter there in Delhi area, New Delhi and Allahabad, that area, there's winter, but not like the winter that we're talking about here. in the mountains area, they may have seen. I have never seen snow until I got here. But if you are near the Himalayan mountains area, that area, probably some of the states there, the people may have seen snow there. But I think the coldest I may have experienced may have been in the 40s, in that particular state.
Okay.
That's very, very rare. So it's not like a parka jacket that you're walking around and, it was a major change in that way.
And the reason I tee it up that way is a lot of change going on in your life,
yeah,
between climate, population, different country. You were originally interested in agriculture when you were back in India.
Yeah.
Where in the timeline after coming to North Dakota and Fargo did you start zeroing in on education and eventually student affairs at higher levels? What caused you to say, this is my destiny?
Okay. Well, I did perform okay in agriculture. It was not with the competence part of it. I think the interest and the talent did not match at all. So, secondly, in India and some other countries like Japan and probably China, some of those countries were the students who will take, select the major when they are in high school. And so once they select the major, it's a lifetime. You never, ever can change it. Think about my own son, my oldest son, changed major at least twice when he was here at NDSU, my other. And so there, you are stuck with a major. Sometimes you're influenced by your parents. And because they will say that, but there is some pressure there in terms of, oh, I want my son to be an engineer. I want my son to be a doctor. So sometimes what happens is they will select the major so that influence on the parents so they can make money or whatever the motivation might have been that you will select certain majors. When I got here, I was in agriculture for a year. And during that period, I was learning about the system here. And I learned, well, I could change the major if I want to. I felt very strongly that there was something troubling. I need to be in the people business. I'm not going to, even though I enjoy certain aspect of the agriculture, I'm a flower gardener, by the way. Now too. And so I can do that as a side, as a therapy if I want to. And so I thought I better find this out more. And somebody sent me to the counseling center. I went to the counseling center and I did a few tests there. They put me through some tests and the interest tests and several other things and came back and they affirmed what I already believed. I should be in a different field. I should be in a different field. That's where my interests and the talents led. So I decided to change the major. And several options were given, and I went to the counseling and guidance program and pursued my master's degree there. I started enjoying that thoroughly and then started looking at what are some of the professions that you can go into if you get a degree in that area. That's where the student affairs come, because the student affairs is a field where you have a varieties of area there. All the way from the admission office, the student housing area, to the enrollment management area, to health field, health science. So student affairs has about 18, 19 areas, spectrum of areas there. And so I said, well, this is a perfect place for me. And I started in student housing. First, in fact, I was an interim counselor in the counseling center and then moved into the permanent job at the downtown Fargo, the Graver Hotel. And in 1976, Development Foundation made a deal with the two other developers in Fargo, former Bill Schlossman, who started the West Acres. So I have the history of Fargo much more than West Acres. And they gave the building partly as a gift and partly the foundation purchased that for the student housing because of demand for housing. And so there was an ad came and said, they're looking for a manager. And I applied for it. And so I was the first manager for the Graver Hotel. And we had people were living there. Some of them were in the apartments upstairs. And so the employees and all those kinds of things, managing that was also part of the job that I had to deal with at that time.
Is that the hotel that had the bar on the main floor?
Yes, Gaslight Bar. And
our band used to play there.
Yeah, what's that?
Our band used to play there.
Really, really. And Bob LaPage. He passed away. Bob LaPage was the manager of that one, and great family. And so managing that, here is a place where I'm managing a place where there shouldn't be any alcohol for the students. So, and, so you are having two entry areas. So one entry to the coming to the foyer area and then going upstairs for their student rooms, and the other entry for the gas light. And managing that, and also the sound and the noise, and the students are saying, oh, can we go there? Well, if you're old enough, you can go there. So it was quite a, even the desk, how that was managed. They had old phone system where you hook up into, you know, into the rooms. And yeah, it was an amazing experience, I tell you that. Amazing experience.
And you were also living there while you were.
Correct. I had an apartment. The first floor, and the first floor is actually the second floor. Yeah, not the main floor. The second, first floor.
So Friday, Saturday nights when the bands were really loud, you probably didn't sleep a lot.
No, not until until it took until about 1:30, whatever the time the bar closed. Until that time, you can hear the pounding.
Before we move on to how your career then moved on from there, Prakash, I graduated from high school in 1972. I never attended one class at North Dakota State University. I never went to school there. Went to two other schools. You know, I have plenty of family members that have, my wife, our daughter, my brother-in-laws who played football, so on and so forth. In the summer of 1972,
yeah,
I was walking past the campus. And when I say the campus, I'm referencing the kind of that courtyard mall area that used to be off where the student union still is, but was at that time. And then there was just this big open space.
Yep.
And there were all these guys playing soccer.
Yes.
And they were short, a player. And they saw, and I had my running shoes on. I'm walking by. They said, hey, do you play soccer? I said, well, I can play sports. And none of them were from here. They were all exchange students from Venezuela, I mean, all over. And then most of them were here for agriculture, engineering, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And this was probably the second most embarrassing moment of my life when it comes to sports. I'm picked up by one of the teams, and probably 2 minutes into the game, a guy comes up and said, you're not very good at soccer. I said, well, I've never really played soccer. And he said, well, maybe you should be a goalie. So they put me in the goal, and after they scored about 5-6 goals on me in a very short period of time, he said, you're not even a very good goalie. So that was my experience with NDSU sports exchange students, and I'll never forget it. I was an absolutely awful soccer player, just for the record. So I
probably played soccer with you that time. I think that at that time period, I was a student, and we played soccer. And one of the leaders of that soccer was a fellow named Beza Aminawar from Ghana. And he was the one who was kind of started the soccer program in the Fargo-Moorhead area for the youth here in the Fargo-Moorhead area. So I give the credit to Beza.
So the area I'm talking about, because for the listener's sake, a lot of exchange students that come from, you know, areas a great distance from North Dakota,
sure,
it's not practical to go home. Yep. For 90 days in the summer, so they stay in Fargo.
Yep.
And that's, you know, that was the sport, and I was just really awful at it, but it was fun. It had a nice learning experience, enough to know that I can't keep up with these guys. So I want to talk about the role of student affairs at any campus setting. It seems to me that function or that department may have more influence on the culture of a campus because of the direct connectedness to the student body in all aspects of their lives, and then, of course, the direct relationship with other department heads. Is that a fair statement to make, that that's a pretty important role?
Absolutely. Because we played I think I don't even know the word of student affairs is the right way to describe, but I think we played the advocacy role for the students. That was our primary role. Along with that, we provided the service. It was a service unit, and all the units that we were responsible for as part of the student affairs happened to be the service units. But I think the number one goal, if I did anything at all, I think the philosophy of letting the employees work in every one of those units, letting them know that we are here for one reason, students. And if we don't model that, the other divisions, whether the academic departments or the finance area or others, they will also start seeing the importance of that, because otherwise they are saying, oh, we are going and fixing things, or we are doing this. But at the same time, the students are the central focus of everything. The universities will not exist. And to this day, I continue to preach about that. And if they start looking at the decision-making and saying that every decision that should be made, that is made in the university setting, they have to say, how is it impacting the students? Doesn't matter what decision. It can be in a very high level decisions. Even there, ask that question. That is one of the things I can say without hesitation, that I challenge every staff member to think that way. Doesn't matter whether you are, whatever the position that you are in, and how is it impacting the students? So I took it upon myself as a model that for them. And so number one is to establish that relationship with the students. Call the student by name. There was a time period in my life, Mike, that my memory was very, very good, very good. I could call most of the people by name. In fact, there was a time period where they come back later as a parent for the orientation program. They test me out because I used to call them by their name. And these same students, they will say, Prakash, who am I? And I'm standing here, and they just test me out. And I used to feel very good about that. I challenge the staff members to get to know the students by name, call them by name. That's number one step for building that relationship with the students. Then get to know them more about them. Second thing, principle, something I learned from another college campus. I left here, North Dakota State, for a short period of time, went to Mankato State University and worked there. The president, a new president came. In fact, I was the chair of the search committee there. And when he was brought in, and one of the things I think he instilled, tried to talk about, was the creating a why not attitude in people. So again, I stole that idea and brought back here to North Dakota State. When the staff members, we are policy-oriented people. And it's so easy for us to say, okay, that's the way it is, because that's what the policy is. The students will come and ask a question. They go through and see an administrator, or they go and see a director, or whatever questions they may have. And so easy for us to answer the question saying, oh, because that's what the policy is. Well, that's not good enough. I encourage them to say that there's a reason as to why they want to come and see you. So create an attitude that the college or the university president and Mankato encourage every student, every staff member to have that attitude, at least have that attitude, create that attitude, say, why not? I'm going to listen to that student. Maybe they will teach me something about it. That's exactly what happened. Most of the time, we will hide behind those rules and regulations. Then we need to open the door and listen to them. Maybe they have a better idea, or they might challenge us. And I also, when they came to me and said they wanted to have the conversation, I would also ask them, give me an idea. Give me an alternative. They can provide a solution and encourage them to come, not just simply telling them what they want us to hear. And also, if they can come up with a solution, maybe that was one of the things I think we transformed the student affairs division at NDSU.
Boy, Prakash, that I'll tell you what I heard there, the buy-in that you're referencing, the buy-in from the students, giving them the ability, I'll come back to knowing their names in a second, giving their ability to, so this is about you, this is about your education, this institution is about the students, and then asking them what they need, what they'd like to see, and when they want to accomplish something, saying, why can't we do that? Why not? That is just so important. And in many areas of our life, we don't have enough of that because of how some leaders opt to lead, for better or for worse. So that's just awesome.
Can I say one more thing?
Yes, please.
You know, if you were to take NDSU's mission statement talk about as the student focus land-grant research institute. So everyone has a role to play about the research. Folks will talk about the research aspect as to why we are research number one, you know, level one. And why are we a land-grant university? And how does that translate into? When it comes to the student focus part, that become your original question about as to our function. That was our job to show how are we showing the campus that we are a student-focused land-grant university, student-focused. We can say that we are student-focused. When I interview the people, we interview the staff members, people will come to me and say, I said, why do you want to be part of NDSU? And they will use, because if you wanted to work in student affairs, they will say, oh, we heard you are a student-focused land-grant university. Guess what? I say, how do you know that? I mean, you read that, right? You read it. But beyond that, how else do you know that? And they said, well, I don't. And I said, well, when you are looking for an employment, that's something you need to really test it out. So I'm going to let you go to this student union. I'm going to give you an hour. I want you to randomly pick about 6 to 8 students and talk to them and say that, are you the central focus of everything that is happening at NDSU? Are you student? Do they practice student focus? And I want you to be honest with me, and I want you to come back to me and tell me that if you're doing that. If we are not doing that, we failed. And that's what the functional student affairs is all about. And when they came back and they say 6 out of 8 students said, yes, that is happening here at NDSU. That means we are doing something okay. Maybe more than okay.
You made me think of another person earlier, by the way, when you were referencing the importance of names and that connectivity. Another incredible servant leader that knew everyone's name and had a memory like nobody's business was Sister Thomas Welder.
Oh, I know Sister. Yes, I know Sister. Oh, what?
Oh, she was so special.
Oh, I know. I met her several times. Oh, she is a saint.
In fact, the last year I played in our band, 1975, we got a job out here in Bismarck at the University of Mary. Two things that are so memorable. One, I don't know if it was a prom or homecoming, whatever it was. They wanted the song Feelings played. We were a rock and roll band. And so we learned the song on the way over, and I think we probably had to play it 5, 6, 7 times. It was just agonizing to have to play it so many times. And I met Sister Thomas Welder. We all did. Fast forward, and you know, and I had hair down to my, you know, below my shoulders. Fast forward to 1985 when I move over here, and I get involved in the Chamber of Commerce. And now I have a lot less hair. I look different. Sister Thomas Welder comes in. She sees me and she says, Mike Seminary, how are you doing? I was absolutely speechless. I didn't look the same, but she remembered me. I'll never, ever forget that. And you're right. Names are so important. Prakash, you retired in 2014?
2014. Yeah, 2014. Yes.
So 7 years ago. So that 30-plus year career of student affairs, a lot of changes in terms of culture took place. At one point in time, there were barely computers on a campus. All of a sudden, everybody's, now they have them in their hands. Some of the most powerful computers are in your hands. When you first came here, we had three TV networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. And we also had public television. Well, all of a sudden, that changed. We had 24-hour cable stations and news 24/7. And then we had big tech introduced, where social media, you could say anything about anybody and get away with it. And that's a blessing and a curse. And those types of impacts to culture sometimes changes people for better or for worse. So I'm teeing it up that way because I'm going to assume that sometimes access and freedom is wonderful, but also sometimes it creates challenges that because it's unforeseen consequences. Did you see that particularly, you know, the last 10 or 15 years of your career, how that influenced and how it changed how you had to address it?
I had to adjust that every 10 years. The type of students that we were getting and their methodology and how they look at things, the advancement, their needs and wants, it was not the same. So if those of us who were in the administration or whatever the position that we did, and we continue to do the same thing over and over again, and then if you're going to give them the answer saying that that's the way it is here, that wasn't good enough. We didn't adjust to the students' needs and wants. And we will not be able to advance at all. And we would have been left behind. Technology, you gave an example about the technology. Many changes. I think there was a time period in the late 70s and early 80s, I think, and I remember the first time I was getting a computer and this big monstrous thing was put in my desk and it was a paperweight. It was sitting there because all the great work was performed in the central office, the front office. And they knew how to do that and we depended on them. And there was this expectation that it was their job. And that's what everybody thought. Oh, this is their job. Why are we doing this in the office? We don't mess around with computers and things like that. That's what the people who are in the front office are supposed to do. And we went through that time period. And then we realized, no, in order for us to serve the students, because the students coming in, they knew how to do that. And you're sitting there and they ask a question and you don't know what they're doing. You better learn about it. And I think I mentioned a little bit about that also when I went to Mankato, and they were already a little bit ahead in terms of technology-wise. And so I had to go and learn at night. And I will take, my wife was a lot better than I was in the technology. So I will take her with me at night. And I said, teach me, because I don't want to fail. I don't want to fail and I don't want to look bad here. And so I had to get very fast, competent in terms of the technology so that I can survive, at least survive in that. That's just one example. I think many, many things in terms of change process happened and we had to adjust to their needs and wants.
Shifting gears a little bit to go back to we are called to do the right thing, again by Prakash Mathew. You can, if you Google NDSU bookstore, that's where you can find the book. Proceeds go to help Dakota Medical Foundation and the hundreds of charities they support through their efforts. Great leadership over there, Pat Trainer and others. I know Pat, I don't know the others.
Scott Holman.
Careful.
Scott Holman, too.
And Scott Holman. Thank you. And so the buying the book makes a lot of difference in so many ways. I want to list the chapters. First one is The Call, My Personal Story, which right away became a page-turner for me. And then To Uphold Values as Guiding Principles, To Practice the 80-20 Principle, To Become a Credible Person. I'm going to pause there. It was there I started looking at the notations, and I realized that we've read so many of the same books, by the way. To Be a Decision Maker, To Do the Right Thing, To Create a Culture, to manage the organizational change process, to be a servant. Which one of those chapters or segments was the most difficult for you and your writers to pen, to write?
That's an interesting question. I think for me, if you notice, the title of the book turned out to be We Are Called to Do the Right Thing. That means that chapter become the focus of the whole thing. And that was not the intent of when I was writing the book. When the people were encouraging me to write the book, it was all about the 80-20 principle. That's what I was doing workshops about for the last two decades. And in fact, there's a reflection a paper wrote in the beginning of that 80-20 chapter. There's a current vice president in one of the Kansas schools. And he was in one of my workshops and the struggles that he went through. And he was able to identify this 80-20 principle. So nevertheless, I didn't put that as the title of the book because as I was writing doing the right thing and gave some principles, and I also use principles from other authors, and what is right and what is wrong, doing legal or illegal, and then come to the part about doing the right thing for the right reason. And the only thing I could really come up with was it was a gut feeling. And you may have done the first two things right, but still the third part came, doing the right thing, and then you based it on gut. And you made the decision, and it may have been a right decision, but you don't know. And when it appeared in the paper, front page of the Fargo Forum or Bismarck Tribune or whatever the paper, and then you're feeling not very good inside and very uncomfortable about the whole thing and saying there's something not right. If you're feeling that way, then there is maybe the decision is not the right one because you're based on gut. So I had to learn about that. So my son was the one when my first time I wrote, my son was the first editor of it because he's a better writer than I am. So he read through that and he said to me, Dad, you need to give a much better explanation about that. And that prompted me to write and explain, what does that mean? Doing the right thing, doing the right thing. And so then I called or invited about six other people from across the nation, some of them locally, and to be a part of that chapter. And so their version of converting that or answering that question or making it an essay about that. And some of them answered all three questions because I gave them doing the right thing for the right reason, doing the right thing for the wrong reason, doing the wrong thing for the right reason. So I gave three choices for them and they can write whatever they want. So if you read that chapter, you will notice that their responses were all so different. And so it was varied, but that's okay. And that made it, I think, answer your question. That was a difficult one, but I think turned out to be my favorite chapter.
I was hopeful that you'd bring up that chapter because, and I don't want to give a lot away because people should read the book. When I read Doing the Wrong Thing for the Right Reason, shortly thereafter, I had to do that very thing. And it was uncomfortable. And the right reason was so powerful that it gave me a little comfort that I did the wrong thing. And it resulted in being able to have a very good conversation with the person that was involved in my decision to do the wrong thing, but for the right reason. And I took great comfort after reading that. And by the way, I'm not saying go out and do the wrong thing.
No.
But sometimes you have a choice to make. And so I remembered that chapter, Prakash, is what I'm saying. So thanks for doing that. So the other side of that question could be, which chapter or segment would gave you the greatest joy in penning and sharing? Well,
the greatest joy, there is something, I'll answer two different ways. In terms of, if this is a toolkit for the management, leadership, and some of those things, I would say that 80-20 principle, I didn't know if that will connect with people. I think I get many, many feedback from people who are struggling in their current positions, or a college student wanting to select a college, or even personal relationship. And they are applying already this 80-20 principle, and they'll come to me and say, I'm benefiting a great deal. That's so rewarding for me to hear that. I think that's exactly what I'm hoping for. If this is making sense for them, and again, there is no magic about this 80-20, by the way. For some people, it might be 10%. Their values might be, they might dig their heels as far as their values are concerned, and they're not going to budge. So they might come back and say, but Prakash, I'm not even go as far as 20%. That's fine. They have to make that decision about that. This is a gauge that, so this is not very scientific. This 20% is not very scientific, by the way. I think I mentioned that in the book also. So that's one way of answering that. But the rewarding part is about, I think it started the book with stories about from the values, who instilled the values and where did I get the values, and the stories about that I'm wrecking a table and eating pineapple stories and some of those things, talking about where, you know, those values stays with you, and that plays a role in your life when you make the decisions. And then ending with the servant leadership part, because that's what my father was. And so everything that I did at NDSU, if I model my behavior to be a servant leader, then I succeeded. If I didn't, if the testimony is going to come back and people, they're going to say to me, more people are going to say that, Prakash, those were all lip service. You did, you know, something else. And if that's the case, then I failed. Then I failed. So I want to say that I wanted to end with the servant leadership because I started with my father and ended with saying that because I learned the greatest thing from my father, but it happened to be the real model came from Jesus. Also, one more thing tying to that chapter that we just talked about the doing the right thing. My moral compass, the moral compass, I think you and I had a conversation, I think a month ago or some like when you wanted to do this. That is what I want people to also remember. What is helping me a great deal in my life, the last several decades, is my moral compass. And when I struggle making the decision, and that is the conscience part, giving me the warning system. And when I know I went and failed, I gave a great story about what happened in India. About 3 years ago, I took my children there, and I just failed miserably. What was happening is the warning system was working, but at the same time, something else overpowered it. And I wanted the result, a different result I was looking for. And I wanted to prove, and my identity was questioned. That's what I was focusing on. My children were bothered about the whole thing. Again, the people may be confused about that answer because they had to read it to find out what I'm talking about. but the thing is, the message here is the conscience plays a crucial role. All of us are conscious. I think in that conscience for me is God. And the moral compass is triggering and saying, Prakash, are you doing the right thing? And maybe we need to bring that in the front end when we make the decision.
Mm. Again, the name of the book is We Are Called to Do the Right Thing by Prakash Mathew. You can Google NDSU Bookstore. The proceeds go to a great, great cause. And I'm one of those people that when I find a book that is of great value to me. I make notes in it. I scribble all over. My Bible is that way. Yep. People ask me, why is your Bible so beat up and you have so many notes in it? I say, well, it's better it's beat up than me. And so this is one of those books where it's up there with the John Mackerels and so many others. Okay, so here's a question for you. You have a magic wand, and you can wave it over the heads of the incoming class, the freshmen of 2021, NDSU or anywhere else. What's the one thing you want them to know?
If they know who you are as a person, I think whether when they enter in college, they are influenced by all kinds of factors. Influenced by, they are guided or influenced by their parents tremendously, and their peers there, and they have this perception that this is what the college life is all about. And I would say that before they enter the college, think about who they are as a person. And I use the term of core values, but that may be too stuffy for them. But at the same time, if they can translate that into who they are, and if they can have some bullet points saying that this is who I am as a person, and can they make a commitment about saying that I will not sacrifice, and we all fail. Knowing that, we all fail. But at the same time, I will do the darnest to keep those values or keep those promises to myself or to themselves. And if they can do that and identify who they are in terms of their weaknesses as well as their strengths and put that there, then they are on the way. And I have made many, many mistakes. And I failed so many times. But at the same time, I think come to a point where through those failures and come to a point where I crystallize my values and can say, these are my values. And there are certain things that you're not going to get 3 strikes for those things. move on. And in my personal thing is, I think we also need to have the faith playing a role in the whole thing. And for me, that is where I find peace in that. And I bring God in the front end. I use the term front end. I don't know if that makes sense for people or not. I use, don't make your agenda God's agenda. I want to emphasize that a great deal. I used to do that a lot because I always thought I had the best answers. I'm a great problem solver, I used to say. And I can solve the problem, and I solve the problem, and then I lobby God to that. No. Sit down and meditate and talk to God and have that time with Him. And then identify the problem, and then just maybe God will help you through those things.
That's a powerful message, Prakash. We're kind of winding up here. First of all, I want to thank you for taking time to join me today. I want to thank you for making the decision to collaborate to write the book. And again, the name of the book is We Are Called to Do the Right Thing, Prakash Matthew. Google NDSU Bookstore. All the proceeds go to Dakota Medical Foundation.
And also,
You
can also get the book in Zambros. And other bookstores in Amazon, all kinds of places too, I think. And NDSU Press. NDSU Press is also, you can get the book.
Awesome. Thank you. And thank you, Prakash, for being you. And going back to what my brother first said about you before I really met you is that he's just the neatest guy in the world. And it's because you love people, you care, you listen. You want the best for people. You are others-centered. And it's people like you that leave legacies, frankly, that are game changers for us. We're all better off because you came here. God had his hand in that deal. and appreciate you. I love you. I can't wait to see you at a football game, by the way. Hopefully we can see each other before that as well. What's the last thing you'd like to share with the listeners and followers of Mike Seminary and Friends, Prakash?
Oh, I think I said enough. And if I haven't had a chance to meet you, and when you see me, I think the other day, just in fact, it was yesterday, I stopped at Barnes & Noble to buy a book. And they didn't have my books there yet because the corporate office make the decision, not the local ones make the decision anyway. And I walked in the door, and there was this woman standing there. And she just practically wanted to embrace me. She said, "You are the person who wrote that book. I'm here to buy that book, and I can find it here. And are you Prakash Mathew?" I said, "Yes, I am. I am." And we had this great conversation. We both walked over to the desk and their service area and talked to a woman named Stephanie, who is the supervisor or something, and talked about it. And this woman and then the three employees said they were also there to buy the books. And so people have been coming in to buy the book at Barnes & Noble. Okay. But my message is, if I can connect with people somehow, if the message is important to them, and if they see me someplace in the street, and I will always say hello to people. Hello. And come and introduce themselves. And I love to meet them, more and more people in this community. And wherever I go, I like to meet them.
Thank you, Prakash. I appreciate you joining me today.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. Mike, you are an amazing person, and you continue to do what you're doing, and you do so well. You do so well what you're doing.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for joining us today. You are profoundly appreciated. Where would I be without the team at Q1 Network? Anna DeVere, Ashley Harris, Bo Hastings, and Marlo Anderson. And my wife, Deb. Deb really orchestrates all of this for me. I have an incredible wife, partner, and friend. Thanks again for listening to Mike Seminary and Friends. Until we chat again, love y'all.